Support for WPR comes from WIPS with Toward One Wisconsin, a conference on equity, diversity, and inclusion, May 7th and 8th in Eau Claire. Registration information and more is at t1w.org.
Support for WPR comes from Present Music, performing honest music with guest violist and curator Nadia Sirota, May 9th at 8 at the Milwaukee Art Museum. Tickets and info are at presentmusic.org.
How are Americans different from our neighbors across the pond? Our guest this hour, from Great Britain, says Americans are notably optimistic and outgoing, but he also says our writing isn't so great and we have a tendency to make patriotism a religion. I'm Joy Cardine. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. It's 8 minutes past 8 o'clock on this Thursday, September 12th. We will talk with the author of Across the Pond, An Englishman's View of America, and we'll wonder if his observations embarrass you, enlighten you, or maybe enrage you. 1-800-642-1234 or send an email to talk@wpr.org. You can also post on the Joy Cardine Show Facebook page. Let me welcome our guest. Terry Eagleton is a British literary theorist and author of Across the Pond, An Englishman's View of America, and he joins us by telephone. Thank you so much for being with us.
Not at all.
So have you spent a lot of time in America?
Oh, I've spent ages in America, yes. I first visited the States actually in 1970, when I was about 26, and I went to teach 200 nuns in North New York State, which was a bizarre experience. I mean, I think crossing the Grand Canyon on a monocycle might be slightly easier, but it was great fun. And since then, I suppose I've taught at a whole number of American universities. I've spent, well, semesters and years in the States, I mean, individual years. And I presently teach at Notre Dame for a bit. I go for 3 weeks every semester. So, yes, I have actually been to the States quite a lot. My wife is American. And although we live in Ireland and my children were born in Ireland, because my wife's American, my children are American and Irish.
Yeah, so why did you want to poke fun at Americans?
Possibly because they don't poke enough fun at themselves, I think. I mean, the Irish and the British are notorious for putting themselves down. You know, grumbling is a national pastime in Britain. We take classes in it to the age of seven, you know, and then we're trained. Sort of self-deprecation, self-irony, self-deflation are very English and indeed very Irish techniques, if you like. Whereas, as I think I say in the book, in Ireland, in America, one tends to bull oneself up. Americans are very assertive, very positive, and that's fine in many ways, but it also perhaps means that they can't quite confront failure and sort of weakness as much, perhaps, as they should, whereas we are connoisseurs of failure. We love failure, you know, ever since Dunkirk and the loss of the Titanic. And so failure is one of our national pastimes, really.
Why do you think Americans are so optimistic?
I think it might have to do with the good old pioneering spirit, don't you? I mean, quite a lot in my book, actually, more than I expected when I wrote it, is about the Puritan streak in the States, which I find extraordinarily marked, even not in the most obvious places, but in less evident ways. And I think perhaps one of them is this, you know, the sense of the human will, which is tremendously strong in America. Much more, we don't, you know, really have much willpower over here, you know, we just lie down and give in to things. But in America, America is the only country in the world, and I've traveled a great deal in the world, where you hear constantly refrains like, if only you try, you can crack it. Yes? Mm-hmm. I knew that anything was possible. I can do anything. It's complete lies, of course, and pretty pernicious stuff, too, because it denies the limitations of humanity, and a humanity that doesn't face its own limitations, I think, isn't really strong. So perhaps we make a little bit too much of breakdown and failure, and I think you might make a little too much of the power of the will. America is very, to an outsider like myself, America is very conscious of America. Yes, I say in the book that the word America is used in America, treating America's families since 1953, or a good American. It's used much more than you would, I think, hear the word, say, Korean, used in Korea, or Scots in Scotland. I think it reflects a peculiar self-consciousness as a society, which at its worst is a kind of bragging. We're the best in the world, as an American customs officer once told me. And otherwise, I think, perhaps reflects the need constantly to assert the unity of an extremely fragmented and disparate sort of place. Has to be kept, as it were, one has to be reminded of the great ideal of America. And the word America is, I think, a kind of ideal word as well as an empirical one. It doesn't just describe a country, it describes a sort of goal, a kind of aspiration, which is not the case with, say, Wales or Argentina.
And of course, then there's the American dream. We're foolish to be pursuing that?
Yes. I mean, I think that's exactly a fine example of what I'm talking about. The idea that, it's a very idealist thing, not only in the sense of idealism, but in the philosophical sense that the will or the mind are paramount and are predominant. That's very un-European. We're buried beneath centuries of history, we've been somewhat crushed in our optimism by it. Whereas it's the youth of America, which I think lies behind, the sense that will, aspiration, power, dream are still possible. One of the great cliches I keep hearing in America is my hopes and dreams. It's a phrase that trips off the American tongue all the time, and it does reflect a very different sensibility, I think, from that, certainly that over here.
You have a lot of fun observations in the book, but I'm going to bring up a serious one now too, and I hope it doesn't turn our whole conversation into this. But our president, President Obama, the other night talked about American exceptionalism. Vladimir Putin, in an op-ed in the New York Times, warns about American exceptionalism, or any country that thinks that it's exceptional, that it is dangerous. What are your thoughts on that?
I think it is dangerous. I mean, it's one of the few things on which I agree with Putin, and there are fewer and fewer things I agree with Obama on, as it happens. But I think it is. I mean, I like countries that don't particularly think highly of themselves. I think modesty is an important national virtue as well as an important personal one. Nobody that I know in Sweden or Finland goes around thinking that they're particularly exceptional. And I don't think that there's much to be gained from it. The opposite of that, however, is the fact that in small countries like Ireland, where I've lived for 20 years, there can also be, it's often said the besetting sin in places like Ireland is begrudgery. If anybody gets above you, you have a kind of incurable instinct to just cut them down to size. In small nations with a history of poverty, with a harsh history like that of some Scandinavian countries or Ireland, there's a genuine begrudging of success, which can be pretty disabling. People sometimes even have to get out if they have success. So that's the other side of the exceptionalist coin, I think.
Well, we have Brad in Whiting with us. Hello, Brad.
Oh, hi there. Yeah, I wanted to mention that Americans have a tendency to think that we can't learn anything from other countries in the world that might be doing things better than us. And we have a sort of a knee-jerk reaction to anything that is publicly run or government-run, saying that it's socialism and leading down the road to communism, whereas over in Europe, they take a different tact. One thing I do like about the Europeans, especially like the French, is they're very involved in politics and government, and they know what's going on, and they'll strike. They're always striking in France, the students, the workers, whereas in America, we aren't as involved that way and aren't as aware of what's going on in our government and just take our democracy for granted, I think.
I think that's right. I mean, I suppose one reason I wrote the book, actually, I never remember why I write books on particular topics, you know, whether, you know, Americans or squirrels or vodka or whatever it happens to be. But I suppose one reason was exactly, as you say, that Americans don't often see themselves reflected in the eyes of others. They're a very long way away from a lot of others for a start, you know. It doesn't help to have two huge oceans on either side of you in that respect. And I was watching television the other night over the Syrian conflict, and an American politician, meaning what Syria's position on something, said, "Where is Syria?" And I thought, well, you know, maybe he doesn't know. Americans are not the most renowned people for their knowledge of geography. So I do think there's that sense of cultural isolation. And I suppose part of the purpose of my book was simply to try to hold a mirror up to Americans, that things that they probably are not aware of, things that they perhaps assume lots of other people do, and actually we don't. I mean, tiny things like if an American comes within 10 yards of you, he says, "Excuse me," because you're used to having a lot of space. You know, well, we don't have any space at all, so we don't say, "Excuse me," you know, that kind of thing.
So what are your perceptions of America's political system?
Yes, the book isn't much about politics, although I make a few remarks, don't I? I say that it's, you know, you're living in a one-party state, mm-hmm. for example. I mean, you know, there's the Democratic Capitalist Party and there's the Republican Capitalist Party and so on, and that relates to Brad's remark about the lack of certain radical traditions there being politically represented at a national level. I suppose certainly the prevailing mood in Europe about politicians is one of deep, deep disillusionment. Politicians are much more objects of fun or anger than they are of reverence. I don't know what people feel in the States about that, but certainly there's been a massive loss of credibility of the whole political class in Europe, not least since the catastrophe of Iraq. I think the continuing catastrophe of Afghanistan, I'd love somebody to tell me why the West is there. And, you know, in one sense, that can just be a matter of disaffection and inertia. But there are energies, too, which I think can be tapped, you know, in other political directions. And I, too, hope that might happen.
We are talking with Terry Eagleton. He is a British literary theorist, author of a number of books. His latest is Across the Pond, An Englishman's View of America. We welcome your questions, your observations for him. 1-800-642-1234 or send an email to talk@wpr.org. You know, we'll talk about some things outside of politics, too, as we move along, like why is it that people in the United States like rising at the crack of dawn even on Sundays? And why is it we don't appreciate the teapot? I'm Joy Cardine. This is the Ideas Network. I'm Joy Cardine. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. We are talking with Terry Eagleton. He is author of Across the Pond, An Englishman's View of America. 1-800-642-1234 if you'd like to react to what he has to say. 1-800-642-1234 or send an email to talk@wpr.org. Well, we have a number of calls, so let's go to Fred in Palmyra next. Hello, Fred.
Good morning, Joy, Mr. Eagleton. I want to differ, of course, with his view. Most of the people that I encounter are generally optimistic, as the guest says. I'm rather pessimistic and set them off at times. I was raised by European immigrants from Germany, and we had things that we would say, like Guten Morgen, Liebes Organ, sind Sie alle schon da, translated as good morning, all you wonderful problems, are you all there? Then let's get on with the day, sort of it translates loosely. And I'm also had enough things happen to me in my life that I'm not generally all that optimistic. Things go wrong.
Yeah, and, but so you agree, though, with Terry that we are maybe overly optimistic as a whole, Fred?
Yeah. It seems that way from what he says, that Americans are that way. I'm not, and it sets some people off. I mean, people greet you, and they expect you to say, when they ask how are you, they expect you to lie and say, oh, good, you know, or everything's fine.
Right.
Most of the time it's, you know, not really. But
I like that saying. Can you say it again? Your German
guten
saying?
Guten Morgen, liebe Sorgen, sind Sie alle schon da, dann ist alles klar.
Thank you very much. We'll get into language, too. And I'm wondering, is it fair to say Americans are optimistic when many are not, or, you know, that we're individuals, Terry?
Well, I'm delighted to meet a pessimistic American. You know, some people think that's a contradiction in terms, you know, like meeting, you know, a highly intelligent wombat or something. Of course, many individual Americans are quite gloomy about world prospects and indeed their own nation's prospects, given the terrible things the bankers have done to Americans and to some rest of us. And they're quite realistic, I think, in being so. There's a distinction, I think, between what individual Americans may or may not feel and a kind of national ideology, almost, a sort of national creed, you know, for which I think quite often, it seems to me as an outsider, negativity is almost a thought crime. Yeah? You know, that you are expected to, as your listener said, you know, you're expected to affirm even when it's unrealistic to do so. And I think that kind of lack of realism is damaging. I think what's important in the end is neither optimism nor pessimism, which are really just temperamental matters, you know. It's realism. And sometimes realism compels one to take a sober and, you know, fairly bleak estimate of the situation, which I think something in the American spirit finds disquieting, you know, finds, as it were, hard to admit. I was watching the other night on television over here a wonderful documentary about the falling man in the 9/11 tragedy and how that dreadful picture, which said so much about the nature of that tragedy, was airbrushed out by the media. Not facing up to the worst of the situation. And if you don't do that, then it's, I think, really quite hard to move on.
Let's go to Richard in Milwaukee now. Hello, Richard.
Oh, hi, Julie. Hi, Harry. Thank you so much. You know, just a couple of quick points. One, the view of Americans that you're expressing, I think, comes from a context of having a short history of 240 years or so. I think you need to reach the 1,000-year mark before you can have a thing called reflection in the society. Americans don't reflect, therefore they, you know, they're full of hubris. And secondly, we have to talk about classism because, as you know, Harry, I mean, Britain, Ireland is embedded in classism. It's not in America. Classism is not as strong here, and so there's this ideal that you can be, you can become, you can do whatever you want to do, and there is empirical evidence of that. We do have a person of color as our president. That's empirical evidence of an embedded racist society in this country that actually, well, we have evidence that classism is not as strong in this country, and maybe you can fulfill your dreams in America.
Thank you, Richard. What's your response to that, Terry?
Classism, interestingly, the word Richard uses, is an American word. There are lots of, nobody uses it over here. I don't mean it. I mean, it's a fairly fine word. But part of the point of my book, incidentally, is to show uses of language, which I think a lot of Americans assume are used by all English speakers and actually are not. They're very native to the States. But I take his point. And I think, indeed, I say in the book that in terms of everyday life, there's a kind of ease and geniality and spontaneity about Americans, which is very, very different from the sometimes rather frigid formalism you find of people in Europe. And that's, of course, the democratic spirit, and it's greatly to be welcomed. But if you, it depends what you mean by class, doesn't it? Class as a social or cultural concept, in that sense, is much more marked, as Richard says, in Europe than it is in America. Class as an economic reality, class as the distribution of ownership and property and wealth and power. Now, in that sense, America is, of course, a very, very class-ridden society, you know, with a tiny elite owning an enormous amount of wealth and huge swathes of poverty. I don't need to say this to many Americans. And I think the sort of easygoing, classless climate of everyday life, valuable though it is, precious though it is, can serve in America to cloak some of those underlying realities which, for better or worse, are much more out in the open in Europe.
Let's talk a little bit about language. You do spend a chapter talking about language differences between Britain and the United States. What are the words and phrases Americans think use?
Oh, my goodness. Now, I should have reread my own book before before I talk to you. I think I give a list at one point. Well, I mean, there are some phrases which are very well known to be different, aren't they? You know,
actually thinking of the title of your book, Across the Pond.
Yes, wasn't my idea actually. That was my my publisher's idea.
I don't like that phrase. It's a stereotype that Englishmen would say across the pond, or
not as much perhaps as one might think. Mm-hmm. Pond is of course used to mean the Atlantic over here. I thought it was over there too. Is it not over there?
It's used enough, yeah.
Yeah. It's not a very good title, actually. Just having a dig at my publisher there in case he's listening.
Like the use of the word awesome in this country?
Well, I don't say I don't like it. I just say that the country would fall apart without it. It is extraordinary to an outsider, again, how often the word awesome or awesome is used. And I think I point out that there are other sorts of adjectives one could use instead, but awesome is, you know, elevators would crash to the ground and cars would fall off the freeways if one stopped using a word like that. Another word that I've heard in the States since writing the book is horrible. You know, rather than saying that something is appalling, or there are various words one can use, horrible is very much an American word, as are tiny phrases like, say, get focused, or zero in, or even reach out to, which are not really used in English or Irish English.
I'm Joy Cardine talking with Terry Eagleton. He is author of Across the Pond, An Englishman's View of America. We are getting his perceptions of Americans, and we're welcoming your questions for him. We're welcoming your reactions to some of his observations. We're talking about how he perceives Americans and our optimism, our relentless pursuit of the American dream, talking about some of the language differences. We'll also talk about coming up some other observation he has. He takes a few jabs at us about our obesity, and we'll talk about that. 1-800-642-1234, or send an email to talk@wpr.org. And let's go next to Mark in Black Creek. Hello, Mark.
Good morning. How are you?
I'm good. What are your thoughts?
I have family from Denmark, and I am amazed when we see pictures from their family there, how comfortable they are with their bodies as compared to us here. Recently, my wife and I took a vacation to Madison, and there was a woman from Europe, and she was at the swimming pool with her 10-year-old daughter, who happened to be in the pool topless. Because at 10, she had nothing to show to be embarrassed about. But people thought it was odd and strange and bizarre. My little boy has diaper rash, and I let him run around naked in the backyard. And people think, that's, oh, my gosh, he's exposed.
Yeah, what's wrong with us?
He's a kid.
What's wrong with us, Terry Eagleton?
Well, interesting that, I'm sorry I didn't get his name, but your speaker talked about being comfortable, not being comfortable with the body. First of all, comfortable is a very, very American word, used much more than it is over here. Are you comfortable with that? Do you feel comfortable? But I have a more or less a chapter in the book, I think, on the body, because Americans are absolutely right. Your speaker is completely right here. Americans are just not very happy about their bodies. And instead of, well, I hope, instead of just indulging in the usual riffs about obesity, because, of course, obesity is a global problem, though I think it's true that I've never seen anybody who blocks the whole aisle of a supermarket except in the States. Rather than doing that, which is rather cliched, I think, I try to dig a bit deeper and talk about America's problem with the body as a kind of problem with the finite. You see, it's again part of this sort of restless aspiration which goes beyond any individual material thing, including the body, yes? The body gets in the way in a certain sense. America is a very, in a certain sense, idealist society in that way, striving for the infinite. And the American dream is a facet of that, I think. And I think some of the discomfort about the body comes from that. The body, it's also a matter of control. America is a society which doesn't like to be passive and having things happen to it which it can't control, as happened, of course, on 9/11. It likes to be in command. It has a certain belief in mastery, which is part of the will, the cult of the will, and it sometimes masters other parts of the world a little too much for our liking, let me say, you know, the understatement of the century. But part of that mastery, of course, is also an attempt to dominate the body, to pummel it and knock it into shape and slim it down, and because anything which is simply given, which is simply raw material, is not, for the Puritan mind, really valuable unless it's been worked upon by the will. Yes, the cult of work, which is one reason why Americans get up at alarmingly early times in the morning. You know, in Europe, we compete with each other to stay horizontal for as long as we can, you know. So I think the body has deeper implications about American Puritanism in general.
Here's a Facebook comment from Jamie. Jamie says, I just returned across the pond from Ireland and Scotland yesterday. I think it depends which country you're visiting, but overall, we are perceived better than we used to be. People knew we were Americans right away, or when we started speaking, but they were gracious and helpful for the most part. It's a good reminder for me to be helpful to foreigners here. So are we, Terry Eagleton, still ugly Americans when we're tourists?
I think I have something in the book about that, indeed, and I think he's right. Americans used to be perceived, when I was a kid and earlier in my life, as extremely arrogant, as braggarts, you know, throwing their weight around. I'm afraid that sometimes they still do that in terms of the globe. They still throw their weight around in a bullying way in the globe. But I think that's much less true nowadays. American tourists are models of courtesy. They try to fit in with people. You know, they may not always be aware of, you know, what building they're looking at, and so on. Their knowledge of anywhere outside the States is sometimes rather lamentably thin. But they certainly are treated, for the most part, in a friendly way, and Americans in general, as I say in my book, are more friendly than most Europeans. There is a difference, actually, interestingly, there, I think, in attitudes towards Americans between Britain and Ireland. I mean, I was brought up in Britain, but I've lived for a long time in Ireland. The Irish like Americans, even though they're actually very, very different people in sensibility. The Irish, for example, have a vein of black, sardonic, satirical, debunking humor, which is very far from what you would get in the Midwest, say, in America. But the Irish, for obvious historical reasons, because the Americans came so generously to their aid, like the Americans, the British, on the whole, don't. At least, they don't like them as much as the Irish do. The British find Americans partly figures of fun, but, of course, also figures to be slightly afraid of, you know, given some of their foreign policy adventures. So there's a rather ambiguous attitude towards Americans in Britain, which I find much less so in Ireland.
Yeah. Are we genuinely loud, that we come across as being loud?
Well, I say in the book that yes, there is a kind of American loudness. For some Americans, you can hear having private conversations from about half a mile away. But then some Europeans are loud too. The further south you get in Europe, you know, sinking towards southern Italy or Greece, the louder people become. But it's not exactly loudness. One of the points I make in the book that I rather pride myself on as, you know, being fairly original, there's a certain kind of resonance about certain American voices, as though they have a kind of built-in amplifier. God knows why this is so. So it's not as though people are shouting or bragging or, you know, it's just that there's a, and this is true of both genders, I find, which means that the voice is all that is amplified, whereas we in Britain tend to mutter much more, you know, that when somebody says to an American, I appreciate it, or something of the kind, you know, he says something courteous back, we just make some unintelligible grunting sound. You know, we're rather shyer than Americans are.
Bill in Ellsworth says that England has more language variables than the United States. He says he used to live in England. People used to refer to the accent that your guest, you, have as a public school accent. Really? What is that?
Well, a public school accent means basically a posh accent, or it means standard English. Actually, I don't speak standard English quite. I was born in Manchester, where there's a very, very strong local accent. So I'd be talking to you like this if I spoke in the way I spoke when I was brought up, like, you know. I then went to Cambridge and Oxford, all kinds of posh places. I never deliberately changed my accent, but over, you know, years and years, it kind of modulated in an evolutionary kind of way. But actually, I have a slight northern intonation, which somebody alert to accents in Britain would hear. They'd hear that I spoke standard English with a slight northern accent. But he's dead right. There's a bewildering number of accents, local accents in Britain. The vast majority of British people speak with their local accent. Only the middle classes speak with standard English. And the local accents can vary so much that, again, as I think I say in Across the Pond, a Geordie, somebody coming from, say, Newcastle, the northeast of England, possibly couldn't understand a Cockney, somebody coming from London, very well, or could perhaps understand each other as well, only as well as a Norwegian and a Dane each speaking their native language. So there is an enormous linguistic variety there.
Tiger in Green Bay is with us. Hi, Tiger. You're on the air.
This is just absolutely fantastic. I'm really enjoying this. I've traveled 22 countries. I've driven about 5,000 miles in Ireland and about 10,000 miles in Europe, so I have a little insight. I was going to say two things. Number one, I've always been amazed by how much interest the Europeans take in our own political system. I would hear more commentary on our current administration, the Bush years and now, and our Congress and everything that was going on in the U.S. politics in a bar in Galway or in Paris, much more than I would hear usually in the U.S. In fact, I had a long conversation about the U.S. debt with a Swiss man in Saint-Chapelle in Paris, as we're in between all these beautiful stained glass windows, we're discussing the U.S. future economically. I thought it was absolutely amazing. But my other point was, Americans are considered so insular that all you have to do is read two paragraphs of a guidebook on a local destination, and everyone will find you culturally sophisticated beyond any expectation. I guess Americans don't, as your guest said, don't know much about anywhere but America, and it shows all too often. But on the other hand, they treat us exceptionally well if we learn just a few phrases and show a little interest in the local going on. And I've always found that very embracing. Even in Paris, I felt that everyone was very warm and friendly if you just acted like you had a little cultural awareness. But anyway, thank you so much to your guest, Mr. Eagleton. I've enjoyed it.
Thank you, Tiger. Do you share that observation that people in Europe are more likely to talk to Americans about American politics than Americans are about to talk about their own politics?
Well, first of all, just the last thing that Tiger said about Paris, if Tiger really did find, if the Parisians were really warm to him, he must be the most engaging man on the planet. You know, he must be extraordinarily attractive for Parisians to be warm to him. He also began his comments, if you remember, by saying, number one, that's American. No person in Britain or Ireland would say number one. They might say firstly or first or whatever. That's just a minor point. Yes, I think Europeans do know a fair bit about American politics, but then, of course, they have to, given the enormous influence of your political system on the rest of us. And, of course, it's almost a cliche, isn't it, to say that the other way around, the American media has so dismally little on what's happening in Europe or elsewhere in the world, unless it pretty directly affects their own interests. You know, there's a lot about Syria for obvious reasons, but I sometimes think, you know, Ireland could just sink slowly into the ocean and it might get half a paragraph in USA Today. It would get an article in the New York Times, of course, but extraordinary insularity in that respect. When I watch, you know, CNN or whatever it is, CBS in the States, I'm appalled by the utter complacent turning away from sometimes quite vital events that are happening elsewhere in a world which is increasingly interconnected. And therefore, you know, these events should make an impact, you know, locally at home in America, but very often they simply go totally unmentioned.
We are talking with Terry Eagleton. He is author of Across the Pond, An Englishman's View of America. And he's giving us his perceptions of Americans. And we're welcoming your reactions. 1-800-642-1234 or send an email to talk@wpr.org. I'm Joy Cardine. This is the Ideas Network. We are talking about how Americans are perceived across the pond with the author of the book, Across the Pond, An Englishman's View of America, Terry Eagleton. And our next caller is Laura in Menominee Falls. Hi, Laura.
Hello, Joy. Hello, Mr. Eagleton.
Hello.
Hello. I would really like to support everything that you've said. My husband and I just returned yesterday also, but we returned from Germany, where we have spent 2 weeks primarily visiting friends. We were not being tourists. And consequently, we had lots of opportunity to really engage people that we knew well in talking about the very things, everything that you're talking about, language, politics, education. And I could comment on almost everything you've said, but the particular reason I called was to say that I had a conversation on a lovely Bavarian terrace with a very educated man whose son had spent a year in Cincinnati, actually, in an internship in a bank. And that year happened to be 2008. And this man's analysis of what he saw as being the essential difference in outlook between Europeans and Americans, I thought, was the most articulate expression of that I had ever heard. And it boiled down to this, that he said Americans take great pride, as you have said, in standing on their own 2 feet, pulling themselves up by their bootstraps, and we expect that by our very will we can make good things happen. He didn't use that language, but that's the gist of it. He said, on the other hand, Germans and all Europeans, from his point of view, had a much greater sense of the community and being responsible to the community. And he said his son, who worked in this bank, was able to observe that colleagues who lost their jobs in 2008 and then faced some kind of crisis, either losing their home or illness, and had to, and literally were almost overnight plunged into poverty and huge financial difficulty, that there was no way that America had to respond to that kind of tragedy, as we know all too well. And this gentleman said, therefore, no matter the cost, that was his phrase, no matter the cost, I will continue to support that we guarantee here in Europe a minimum standard of safety for our people so that they do not tumble into this kind of situation. And that spoke volumes to me about the difference. And we hear so often that such attitudes are called socialism. But if that's true, then why are people safer in Europe from such tragedies as many of our people have experienced? So that was a very poignant moment for me that he had personal experience through his son and that he was transferring it to his own attitudes in his own country. Mm-hmm. So that's my contribution today.
Thank you for it. Terry Eagleton?
Yes. Now, that was very interesting, what Laura just said. I think there is, I mean, quite a lot of what some Americans call socialism, of course, is actually social democracy, which is a much milder version, and I think that's what Laura was really talking about. Some Americans can't even make that distinction. Social democracy being, you know, in my book at least, just the obligation of the community as a whole through the action of the state that represents the community to care for all of its members. And that communitarian spirit is absolutely vital, I think, to a just and sane society. It is threatened in our world, not just in America, but elsewhere, by a kind of rampant individualism. And, of course, individualism goes very deep in America, again, in part of a Puritan heritage, for which, as it were, autonomy, self-determination, self-dependence are paramount. I think that's actually, you know, philosophically mistaken, not just politically. Any independence that human beings can negotiate for themselves has to go on within the context of a much deeper and greater dependency. Essentially, human beings are dependent animals. If we weren't cared for in the first weeks and months of our existence, we would perish very rapidly. We are born prematurely. We're born helpless. We need society, community, culture to move quickly in upon us, otherwise we would die. And that need remains even when we come to a degree of independence. Our independence has to be negotiated in and through our inevitable dependency on others. Now, so I think there's a profound philosophical distinction, as it were, between, in terms of what Laura is talking about, between a certain conception of liberal individualism and a certain communitarian conception that doesn't need to take the form of socialism, though I am myself a socialist and proud of it, but is being rapidly eroded in a world where individuals seem less and less to be concerned for each other. The one thing that we do, Laura was talking about the economic crisis, I suppose the one thing that unfortunately the United States and Britain have in common is that in neither country are any bankers in prison. There are lots of people in prison who shouldn't be there, but the people who should be there in both countries, shamefully, are not.
You see a connection between sports, religion, and patriotism in the U.S. Talk some about your suggestion that patriotism is a religion here.
Let me just say a word about sport first. I often get or risk getting thrown out of taxis in various countries, not just in America, by when they say, are you here for the game?
Uh-oh.
Whatever the game is, I say, no, I believe sport should be abolished.
Oh, no.
Oh,
you're talking to the home of the Green Bay Packers, but that's
that
okay.
Is fighting talk. Certainly fighting talk in the States. It's fighting talk anywhere, actually, these days, because, of course, sport is a kind of religion. You know, the opium of the people these days. It's not, as Mark said, religion. It's sport. What would the societies do without it? Some way of harmless and distracting people, giving them kind of from other rather important issues, giving them a kind of substitute sense of solidarity, a sense of heroism and history. America loves heroism. Hero, you hear, the word hero you hear much more in the States than anywhere in Europe. You know, sport is quite vital to the workings of these societies. You know, as the Romans knew all about bread and circuses to keep the people busy, you know, the common people, and I think that's the same. I say, I think, in the book that, well, sport, of course, is enormously important in the States. I teach at Notre Dame, and I, you know, could hardly ignore that fact. But patriotism, well, there are different forms of patriotism. There's a kind of British patriotism which consists in running your country down most of the time, a most un-American pursuit, but then in moments of crisis, you know, when the Germans attack you or something of the kind, suddenly becoming very kind of, you know, Winston Churchill-like and square-jawed. But most of the time, patriotism would be more of an embarrassment in I think, in Britain or Ireland. I mean, a small detail, of course, nobody at all in Britain or Ireland, or indeed most European countries, would fly the national flag in their garden. You know, they would think that was rather silly. They might fly the flag of the local football team, but not that. Like a lot of things in the States wears its, as it were, wears its heart on its sleeve much more so than in Europe. In Britain, the assumption is things work best when they're not explicit, when they're deeply embedded in the national unconscious, when they're just part of your culture. The United States is a much more upfront place than that, you know? And therefore patriotism is something much more explicit and articulate, whereas we tend to believe that it works best when it's somehow tucked away a bit.
Well, I wish we had more time. We're running short. I do want to know, what do you think is the best thing about Americans?
I say there are lots of things that I list in the book here and there, I think. It's hard to say what is the best. There is a kind of courtesy and kindness and geniality and friendliness about Americans, which is all the more astonishing and all the more, as it were, admirable because of you know, they live in a society which in many ways is pretty harsh, you know, for a lot of people. Pretty go-getting, pretty ruthless, pretty militaristic, and yet, quite surprisingly, so many Americans individually have managed to preserve that sense of outgoingness. It's very striking to us rather sort of emotionally retarded Brits, you know, where there's much less, I think, as I say in the book, you know, if somebody was lying, dying in the gutter, the British would walk by, not because they're hard-hearted, but because they wouldn't like to interfere with their privacy. Yes. There's much less of that, I think, in the States. The States, people in the States can be moralistic and self-righteous. There's a lot of self-righteousness in the States, I think, and moralizing, sententiousness. But the flip side of that, I think, is a genuine kindness which has survived, in a way, against many odds. Whereas, you know, as I think I say in the book, if somebody speaks to you in an elevator in Britain, then you would instantly ring security to cart them away as a dangerous lunatic, you know. Whereas, you know, and if you give them their head, they're bound to end up, you know, trying to kidnap you or, you know, mugging you. Whereas, of course, you know, if you step into an elevator in the United States with somebody else, they would normally just say a nice, polite word to you, which is rather charming.
We are out of time. Thank you so much for being with us.
Not at all.
Terry Eagleton is author of Across the Pond, An Englishman's View of America. Thanks to Christy Taylor for producing and directing this hour. Thanks to Bill Martins for on-air production. Thank you for joining us. I hope you stay tuned. There's much more to come. And I hope you are with us tomorrow at this time when we will talk with two guests from different political viewpoints about the top state, national, and international news stories of the week. It's our Week in Review tomorrow between 8 and 9. I'm Joy Cardine. This is the Ideas Network.